something to do to keep your mind sharp and the rest of you too. It's fun to move around and it's good for you, 'cause everybody needs something to do. Get up, you gotta do something. Get up, you gotta do something. Get up, you gotta do something. You gotta do something that's fun for you. You need to jump like a kangaroo. You need to jump, it's an easy thing to do. You need to jump like a kangaroo, 'cause everybody needs something to do. You need to sway from side to side. You need to sway just like you're on a ride. You need to sway from side to side, 'cause everybody.
Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Lenox, Massachusetts-based writer, producer, actor, and musician Terry Hall, or as he is better known, Terry a la Berry, who performs for children and adults. A percussionist who trained at the Boston Conservatory and the Berklee School of Music, Terry a la Berry toured and recorded with Arlo Guthrie for 14 years, something he occasionally does right now. He's also appeared on screen and stage as an actor in A Cry of Prayers, Alice's Restaurant, The End of the Road, and Renato. Aldo and Clara. Terry a la Berry. Terry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's so great to be here with you, Alan. Usually I see you from on stage or I see you rushing by somewhere, so I'm so glad I get to actually sit and talk to you for a change.
So how did you get to be who you are? Your mother is a remarkable woman.
Yes, she
is. Start with that.
Well, she's now 94 years old and is going strong, and she's a playwright. Growing up, she was a drama teacher at a private school in the Berkshires where I went. It was called the Windsor Mountain School. And it's no longer there, but it was around for quite a while. And my parents worked there.
And so I know this because my wife is writing a book about that very school and has interviewed your mother many times.
This is quite true, and mm-hmm. I can't wait to read that book.
Well, she's working hard on it. Terry, any siblings in the family?
Yes, I have an older brother who's a detective. He writes detective novels.
Really?
He's written about 35 books.
And what's the name?
Parnell Hall.
Yes, I think I've seen that.
He's quite well known in the mystery circuit.
Yeah.
And I have a younger sister, Katie, who is a pediatrician on a Native American reservation in Montana.
You have a good family, that is for sure. So tell us a little bit about how you got to be a drum player. How does anybody get to be a drum player? I don't want one living next door to me.
No, you would not. And I don't think my parents did either, but my father used to take me to Tanglewood all the time when I was young, whether I wanted to go or not. It was just something that we did together, and I grew to love it. And I used to go backstage and talk to the drummers because I loved percussion. And so I got to know Arthur Press, who was the assistant timpanist, and I started taking lessons from him when I was about 10 years old or so. And I would actually, during the winter when he was back in Boston, I would take the bus once a month to Boston and have a lesson. So he was kind of training me to be a classical musician. And
I was going to say, you have to learn to read music when you dig from the assistant timpanist.
You sure do. And you have to learn to play the right way. And it was a great education. But I really wanted to play rock and roll. So eventually, after Boston Conservatory and a little time at Berklee, I rebelled and went on the road with a band.
Well, you mentioned your father. What influence did he have on you?
Well, he was not musical at all, but he had a real appreciation for music. So growing up, when I would go to bed at night, they would put Mozart on for me to go to sleep to, or Beethoven or whatever.
They were way ahead of their time, because now we know if you put Mozart on, your kids are smarter. That's according to all the literature.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So he really instilled in me a love of music, I think he was really responsible.
What did he do for a living?
He was also a teacher at the Windsor Mountain School. An English teacher and a wonderful man.
Tell us about how you played your first gig.
Well, I got hired when I was 13 years old to play at what was called the Berkshire Playhouse then. Now it's the Berkshire Theater Festival in Stockbridge.
Actually, now it's the Berkshire Theater Company, isn't it? That's Kate McGuire.
Okay. And
because they took over the Colonial Theater.
Right. So I was 13 years old, and they needed a drummer for the Three Penny Opera. And for some unknown reason, they hired me. And it was a wonderful thing. David Grover, who I would go on to play with, was also hired. He was 13, and we were both in the pit together.
How much money did you make at that gig?
$75 a week.
Wow.
Which actually was
a lot. At that time, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, I used it. After Three Penny Opera, they were nice enough to hire me for two more musicals that summer, because I guess I did a good job. And then for the next 5 years, I was the house drummer there.
Who puts the bands together? I've often wondered that. You see these wonderful musicians like Jeff Stevens and other people at some of these gigs. And does somebody go out and create a band, or does somebody, the leader, who picks the band?
I think it's pretty much by project, or by, they might have a musical director for the summer who would be, their job would be to go out and find good players. Back then, it was a wonderful man named Bob Blayfield, who also was a choral director, and he was hired for that summer to be the musical director, and he found me, and he found Dave, and took a chance on putting 13-year-olds in the pit.
That's amazing. That's just amazing. What did that do for your ego?
It's great. I don't know if it's as much ego as just... more like self-esteem,
well,
that you could do something.
True ego. I think you can interchange those. Maybe
right.
I'm wrong. Yeah.
But music is what I wanted to do for my life. And so to be able to start actually working and have responsibilities at that age was a great thing. And the second season that I was there, well, actually when I was 15, they cast me in a speaking role in this play called The Cry of Players that Bill Gibson had written, really for Anne Bancroft to star in.
Which he also wrote The Miracle Worker.
Right, and so they'd worked together before, and that's how he was able to get her up to Stockbridge.
He lived in Stockbridge.
Yes, he did, and he was a kind and wonderful man, and I miss him too. But it was a great experience to get to be in a play with somebody of Anne Bancroft's stature.
How was that?
It was remarkable. I loved working. I really count her as one of the biggest inspirations in my life growing up, because, you know, at 15 years old, it's really a key time when people can really make an impact. And I learned so much about acting, and just about, if there's anybody that really epitomized the word class, she was a classy person. And a wonderful actress.
So beautiful, so wonderful. Do you remember one interaction with her that stands out in your mind?
Oh, totally. My part in the play was she had to say something. I can't remember what the lines were, but for some reason, I was supposed to blush. I was supposed to get embarrassed by what she said. And I wasn't a trained actor. I was a 15-year-old kid, you know,
well,
having the time of my life.
Now, 15-year-olds have hormones, of course, and she was quite beautiful.
Well, here's the thing. This was the summer after she had been in The Graduate, which I had seen, and and she was Mrs. Robinson, incredibly. So she got this idea at the rehearsal that she just went into her Mrs. Robinson character, and she just started talking to me kind of as Mrs. Robinson, and I turned purple and green and every color under the rainbow, and it worked. It was just the motivation that I needed. So then for the whole run of the play, we did it for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. All she had to do was every night on stage, she just looked at me. She looked me in the eye, and I had no trouble blushing.
Was she a method actor?
She had... I learned a lot of things from her. She had trouble memorizing lines, just like I always did. And she had, in her script, she would draw pictures of little things that would remind her of what the lines were about. And that way, when she wanted to remember her lines, she would mentally think of the picture that went along with that particular speech or something, which was a Great trick.
Were all your little friends incredibly jealous of the fact that you were acting with Mrs. Robinson?
I suppose they were, but I never really, never took the time to think about that. It was too great an experience. Oh, and the topper of that was the fact that she was married, of course, to Mel Brooks.
I was going to mention that. They were married on Fire Island, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Where my parents had a little shack.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
And he, to me, is one of the funniest people who has ever lived.
There's nobody funnier ever.
And so after the rehearsals, they were staying at a place called Wheatley, which is right up the street from where I live in Lenox. So I was 15. I couldn't drive. And after rehearsals, they would give me a ride home.
No kidding.
So I was driven home every day by Mel Brooks and Ann Bancroft. And he was as funny in the car as he is, in real life.
Oh, that's really great. So you do this play. And what does that do for you?
Well, the play went on to Lincoln Center for, several month run. And I desperately wanted to go. And my parents decided it wasn't, it wasn't in the cards.
How
for
come?
A 15-year-old. Well, I couldn't live on my own. It wasn't like they were going to, quit their jobs.
Be stage parents,
And they just didn't think it was a good smart move.
Were you to go to the psychoanalyst's couch, would this be something that you might want to raise?
No, I don't think so. It would have been a temporary thing anyway. It wasn't like it was running on Broadway for years. It was just a few months. And I know the guy who took my part. He's an actor named Chris Tabori, who I got to know pretty well. And he once told me, he said, "Yeah, it's terrible in the rehearsals. They keep saying, 'You're not doing it the way Terry did it.'"
Oh, that's
so very that made me
funny.
Feel good.
That's very funny.
But I have no regrets about that.
Do you ever think in life, Terry, that if you're in this place at this time, something goes forward, but if you're not in that place, it doesn't go forward?
That's right.
And who knows, right?
I think that I got more chances to do more incredible things growing up because I lived in the Berkshires than I ever would have had if I lived in New York or Los Angeles or somewhere like that, and I had gone to every audition in the book and tried to pursue either a musical or an acting career.
What with, Terry Alaberry, otherwise known as Terry Hall, or Terry Hall, otherwise known as Terry Alaberry. So let's just do a little bit of a précis here. Bill Gibson, one of the most famous and important playwrights in America, you knew. You knew virtually the entire Stockbridge group. How about Norman Rockwell?
Norman Rockwell, I never met. I saw him riding his bicycle around Stockbridge from time to time, but never got to actually meet him, which I certainly regret.
And there's that wonderful part of Alice's Restaurant, the film, in which a very young Arlo, he was young, film dummy, sitting there in the school, I guess the Stockbridge school, and having the guy get mad at him because he wasn't listening, as I remember, to classical music, and he was playing jazz on his little practice piano. Was that you also?
I think so. I liked classical music. I still like it to a certain extent, but it wasn't the world that I wanted to be in. I wanted to be the Beatles. I mean, we all wanted to be the Beatles. We saw all the girls screaming and, how exciting it was. And what they did for music, turned everybody on their ear, and certainly me.
What Marx did for Hegel.
Yeah.
They always say he turned him on his ear. the political philosophers do anyway. So wait a second now. So Arlo himself, tell us about how that hookup began.
Well, I never met him. I was in the movie, and I worked on it for about a week or so. I'm the first person you see in the funeral scene, and I was in the wedding scene at the end playing a hippie. But I never really got to meet him except to say hello. And then years later, when we started our band Shenandoah, we had been together for about a year.
The band had.
And we were playing around
the
Berkshires.
Who else was in the band?
David Grover. and another wonderful singer named David Karen, who's passed on, and a bass player named Danny Velika, who also recently passed.
Oh, boy.
And it was a really good band, and a lot of people were impacted by what we were able to do in just a few years, actually. I think David left after about 3 or 4 years. And
you were out on the road a lot, right?
We were. What happened was we were together about a year, and
how
Arlo
old were you
started.
At this, how old were you at this point?
Had to be maybe about 20 or so. I had left music school to play with a band called Quarry, which was similar members. And when that band disbanded, Shenandoah sort of took its place after a little time. But Arlo kept coming to see us, and which we thought was nice, but, you know, we were
now, was
sort of
Arlo
surprised.
Arlo at that point of the game?
He was, because he had had Alice's Restaurant, was a big hit, and actually when we first started with him was right after he had had the hit with City of New Orleans, which was probably his biggest popular hit. I mean, Alice's Restaurant, certainly the biggest known thing.
Well, Alice's Restaurant, you think about that for a second. Alice's Restaurant, the song,
right,
is what White Christmas is to Christmas. You know, this is to Thanksgiving. Every Thanksgiving we get in the car, 12 o'clock on it comes, on places around the country. So he has the number one Thanksgiving official song of all times.
For sure. For sure. But I would think that City of New Orleans is probably the song that most of the general public would know him from.
Wasn't that covered by a lot of other people like Joan Baez and people like that?
Yep. And, oh, gosh. Yeah, long list of people who have done it.
Yeah. So, but Arlo gets the credit.
Steve
Goodman
gave it to Arlo, and Arlo changed it quite a bit from Steve's original version and turned it into what it is today and what everybody else copied. So when John Denver did it, he really did Arlo's version of Steve Goodman's song,
right,
in my opinion.
Oh, no, that's why we're here, and that's why we're talking to Terry Hall, otherwise known as Terry Alaberry. Terry Alaberry, how did you come up with Alaberry versus Terry Hall?
I didn't. It's back to Arlo. When we first started with him, we went to Chicago to play in a little club. Actually, the club, it's called The Quiet Night, where Steve Goodman gave Arlo the song.
The famous story
before.
About, hey, Arlo, would you listen to my song? Okay, man, if you buy me a beer, I'll listen to anything you got. Okay, so there's a story. Steve Goodman gives it to him, and then he plays. He always tells that story every performance.
Yes, he does.
The song, yeah.
But anyway, we went to Chicago to sort of break in the band doing a three-night stint.
Right.
And we were in the dressing room the first night, and Arlo said, oh, gosh, I got to introduce you guys, and I don't know your last names. You know, he just knew us casually. So he went around the room, and he got to me, and I said, my name's Terry Hall. And he just frowned, and he looked at me, and he went, that's really boring. I think you're more like Terry Alaberry. And he went out and introduced me as Terry Alaberry, and from every night after that, and I've been Terry Alaberry ever since.
Does it ever make you skitsy?
No, it the first record that we did with Arlo, it came out and it said Terry Alaberry, and my mother cried because she said, how are the relatives going to know it's you? But she got over it. And years later, when I started singing for kids, it was the perfect name. I mean, I couldn't have picked a better name because it's easy to remember. It's fun. I can remember it. And so it was just a natural. So I really give Arlo a lot of credit for figuring out who I should be.
So sticking with the story, Shenandoah is formed. You go out on your own for a while. It's rough on the band, as I remember some of the stories. Yeah, some guys drank too much. Some guys did this and that. You know, it was a tough thing. And then Arlo comes to see you, and he decides, I want this to be my band, my backup band.
Right.
So?
So we, you know, thought for like a split second and said, oh, hey, that's a great idea. And it was a great idea, and we had a ball on the road. It was difficult.
Were you a good boy on the road? I mean, were you a good boy, or were you acting out? You were young. Women, wine, you know, stuff.
Well, I wish there were more women. Oh, I liked to drink a lot of beer in those days. We all did. We'd sit on the bus and play cards and drink beer all day.
Was Arlo on the bus with you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That's when he first started. We were on his first bus. And
did he own the bus?
He did. He got it for, we were doing a tour to support a kind of a little-known presidential candidate named Fred Harris in 1976.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah. And I don't know exactly how Arlo got involved in it, but we ended up traveling the country kind of with Fred, doing these sort of campaign stops, and we had Secret Service people around and everything. And so Arlo bought a bus for that tour, and that was the first kind of big bus tour that he did, and he's been doing them ever since.
He's had several buses since that time.
Yep. Yep.
They're quite extraordinary. So you're touring with him, and then what happens next? When does Pete come into all of this?
Pretty soon, because Arlo had done shows with Pete before that. They'd done them, just the two of them.
There'll be some young people, I hate to say this to you, Terry, who are listening right now who don't know we're talking about Pete Seeger. But
the wonderful, the world's legendary Pete Seeger, okay. Who's... you know, the father of folk music.
Indeed he is.
And we were so lucky. We had no idea how lucky we were. Usually during the summers, we do a handful of concerts with Pete. And they'd be the bigger venues, Tanglewood. We did Tanglewood, and we did all the sort of Tanglewood.
Was music in or not?
We did music in.
Yeah.
It was still going at that time.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful, wonderful man. And
so how did that get? I mean, you know, I've had some chances to be talking to him over the years, and, you know, it always strikes me as a fairly serious guy. You know, he's not slapping you on the back.
Nope. He cuts right to the chase.
Yeah, right. So what was that like, being with Pete Seeger?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful, because he's also very funny, tells lots of great stories all the time, and... as you know, there's not a piece of ego with Pete.
He's quite the contrary.
Just, you know, you're sitting in an airport with him, and he'll strike up a conversation with the guy sitting next to him, you know, about some global issue, and he's just Pete all the time.
It's one of the reasons, this is your interview, but I have to tell you, I remember I had it all set that we were going to name the bridge over the Hudson after Pete, Pete, because he wasn't dead by any means. I went to the governor at the time, Patterson. I went to the head of the ENCON department, Judy Ink, and everybody signed on to it. Till one day, I got a call from Tao, his grandson, who said, "Grandpa says, cut it out." You know, how many honorary doctorates this guy could have had if he wanted them?
Just, for sure.
Not the way he is.
Nope.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, so there you are with Pete. Does he teach you anything?
Oh, I couldn't put my finger on one thing, but he taught us everything.
Well, here's a question. You know, there's the famous story about Pete and Dylan, you know, and that some people say it happened, some people say it didn't happen, you know, when it was the question of whether or not when Dylan became electrified and, you know, Pete apparently, allegedly, I believe Pete, I always believe Peter about everything, didn't do it, but took an axe to the to the cable.
Oh, I can see that happening.
Yeah, right. Well, we know that Pete is a wonderful axe man and cuts his wood. I think he's still cutting wood.
Still.
To this day, yeah. So here you are, a drum player. Now, that's interesting because the Weavers didn't have a drum player.
No.
And the Almanac Singers didn't have a drum player.
That's right.
And when you were introducing a drum player to the mix, that was kind of radical, wasn't it?
I would think so. And we also were a pretty electric band at that point, especially when we started with Arlo. You know, all electric guitars and a lot of harmony, like Beatle-like harmony things, and kind of out of Pete's normal character, for sure. But I think that's maybe why he had so much fun playing with us. We did some big shows at Wolf Trap that were on public
PBS.
Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Pete just adapts to anything. So he'd just jump in. He'd play with us on songs that he never played before. You know, he didn't care. He'd just jump up with his banjo and so I think he adapted to us quicker than we adapted to him.
There's a wonderful song on one of the albums, Precious Friend,
right,
in which he is calling out to each of you to take a solo. And he said, okay, men, and Carol, who is the wife of Steve Ide,
right,
who was playing the washboard, yep, you know, at the time. That was fabulous, just fabulous.
Yeah, those were wonderful times. And I hope I'm not speaking out of turn to say that I'm so thrilled that we're doing a Guthrie Family Show at Carnegie Hall this year, and Pete is going to be joining us.
Yes, I knew that, and it's a wonderful thing. We've been there every year, and it's just been, you know, fabulous to watch the whole family growing up. Arlo brings all the kids out and everything. Now, when does Abe Guthrie enter into all of this?
Abe used to come on the road with us when we were doing Shenandoah tours. He actually went to Europe with us. We did a Woodstock anniversary tour of Europe, and he was a kid. He just came along to, you know, see
the world.
But
he's a tall kid.
Well, yes. But after that, he started coming on tours, and gradually he played a little bit, you know, played some keyboards. And by the very end of, I was the last Shenandoah member standing after 14 years.
What happened?
They all just sort of dropped out. It's a rough life. You
were
have
they
to
kicked
really,
out or were they dropped
no,
out?
No, no, nobody was kicked out. Arlo's not like that. Uh-huh. You know, it was just a gradual kind of thing. It's very hard being on the road. And it's very
Why
hard
is it
being
so hard?
On the road. Well, the schedule is tough. We would be out for a month and a half and then come home for a few weeks, go out for 3 months, come home for a few weeks. It's hard to have a normal family life and do that.
Did you have family by that time?
I didn't at that time. Actually, I didn't get married until I was off the road with Arlo. There was a period where I didn't go on the road.
So, okay, I got
number of years.
A couple of years, yeah. So who'd you marry?
I married a wonderful person from Cummington, Mass, who I met doing a play at the Berkshire Public Theater years ago. I was doing Christmas Carol, and I was in it, and she was too, and I met her there, and you know, we ended up getting married in Arlo's church.
And how old were you then?
I got married late. I was maybe 38, 39.
That's when they're all doing it now, you know.
Yes, and we were together for about 11 years, and it was really wonderful. But then she decided she had other things in her life that she wanted to do, that marriage just wasn't, you know, sitting well. She didn't like having to stay in one place. And
did you think you're being on the road interfered in that?
I'm sure it didn't help. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't help with any of the people in Shenandoah. So they eventually, one by one, as they got families and kids and things, they left the road. So I was the last one. And then Abe, at that point, he had joined the band. So it wasn't really Shenandoah anymore. It was me and Abe and several other people who came in and out. And Abe, I can't say enough about Abe.
He is the sweetest guy ever.
As long as he doesn't hear this.
Yeah, he won't hear it, don't worry.
I'll tell you that he is one of the finer people that I know. He's so talented as a musician and as an organizer. Like, he really manages everything that's going on around Arlo on the road, from the technical part.
What do you mean? Give us an example.
I just think
the mics are set up and things like that, or not?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, Abe, he does our monitor from on stage. He controls our monitor sound. He sets up, he doesn't physically set up every piece of equipment, but he knows what every piece of equipment's doing, and he takes the responsibility for it.
But he's not like Arlo. I mean, Arlo is outgoing, you know, that kind of thing, and is just able to tell any story to any person.
Right.
Abe is sort of silent.
Well, only on stage.
Yeah, right. Right.
It's a funny thing. He's, you know, he's a lot like Pete. he's got no, he really couldn't care less about being the center of attention. He never wants to be the lead singer. You can't get him to be the lead singer on a song, even though he's got a great voice and he's a wonderful singer. He sings backgrounds with Arlo. He can arrange all the backgrounds. When we have the Burns sisters with us on the road, Abe is key in arranging all the parts. And he just, and he's also a technical wizard. I mean, when it comes to computers, anybody's computer that needs to be fixed, Abe's absolutely knows what to do about it.
Good. It's good to remember that. I'll be calling him.
Yeah. Yes, he'll appreciate that. Sorry,
so,
Abe.
So what about children's songs? I mean, you're really known as a superb purveyor of children's songs.
Oh, thank you.
And, you are. And you've done records and many performances. Tell us how all that came about.
Well, I worked, David Grover was in the band Shenandoah.
Yes.
And so I worked with him ever since we were 13 for years. And
are you the same
left.
Age, basically?
We are.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he left playing with Arlo after 3 or 4 years, maybe, to start a family. And I kept on. And when Arlo wasn't going to have the band out on the road, Dave was already doing children's music in the Berkshires.
Indeed, every Saturday morning at the gazebo in Great Barrington.
That's right.
Maybe 500 people out there.
Yep. And so he asked me if I wanted to, he needed somebody to kind of co-run his record company because he was starting to make children's recordings. And he needed somebody to kind of handle that stuff. And I wasn't doing that much. So I took on that job. And that sort of morphed into performing with him. And then we found Kathy Jo at the Berkshire Public Theater.
To whom he is now married, but not at the time.
He's now married. That's correct. And
funny how that works.
So out of that formed the Big Bear Band, which was the three of us for 18 years.
Really? 18 years?
Yep. 18 years. I was at the bandstand every Saturday morning without fail. And so it morphed into that. And then over the last 10 years or something, we've sort of drifted our separate ways. Dave wanted to pursue other things and didn't feel that the Big Bear Band was that important anymore. And so I was naturally sort of
Jackie
morphing.
Jackie went into his cave.
Oh, no.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I was sort of naturally morphing into doing a lot of writing songs and performing on the side on my own anyway. And so I've just been doing that, and I love it. I love it.
How do you get gigs? How do you get paid?
You don't. That's a big problem. But you just, you know, I try and get my name out there, and it's
well,
not
you're
terrific.
My...
It's, oh, thank you.
And how does anybody get you if they want you?
Well, I have a Facebook page, of course, Terry Oliberi, and they can get me through there. Or I have a website, you know, terryoliberi.com.
It says Oliberi, A, space, La, space, Berry, capital B, right?
On the website, I think it's all,
one word.
I don't think there's any spaces. Yeah, it's just Terry Oliberi.
Well, experiment with it, folks.
Yeah, but people can find me.
For birthday, you do birthday parties and things like that.
Oh, occasionally, yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
What I love to do are go into schools, and I love to play at churches and temples and civic organizations. And wherever there's a bunch of kids, I'll do it. But I'm a terrible businessman, so I don't drive a very hard bargain. You know, people call me up and...
Don't you need to get somebody who does that for you?
I know. I keep looking for the right person, somebody that has a little time and would make the phone calls for me, because I'm just... so pathetic. I end up sort of offering to pay them to let me play. And that's not going to work out too well in the long run, but I don't care. It's you can be having the worst day in the world, feeling terrible, just everything's going wrong, and you go and you sing for kids for an hour, and you come back, you're so invigorated. By the time we're done with one of our shows, I feel so great about the world, because it's the kids that make the difference. You know, I'm only there so that they'll have a good time.
So when you say we're done, who else is in this?
Generally, when I do shows, being a drummer, I'm not very good at guitar. When I record, I can play piano or something, but I don't want to do that when I'm playing live. I want to be free to spend the time with the kids and let them run around and me run around. So I have to have a couple of people accompany me. And I've got two wonderful women who are my main accompanists as long as they're free. And they're both mothers who have now grown kids. And one's Elizabeth Berlinger, who lives in Housatonic, right across from Arlo's Church. And that's where I met her. And another woman named Tish Merwin, who lives in Lee. And they've been my main support.
So you're still going out on the road with Arlo, aren't you?
Yeah, and I love it more now than I ever did. We've been out for pretty much the last 5 years.
Really?
On a pretty regular basis, either with the family or with the band that has the Byrne Sisters and Bobby Sweet and some other great people.
And so when you go out, and it's different from the old days when you were a kid.
It's totally different because, you know, back in the old days, we were all wondering what our careers were going to be. You know, we always wanted to be big in the music business, and we thought we wanted to be rock stars. And now when I go out, it took me a long time to realize it, but I'm exactly where I want to be. I'm doing exactly what I want to do. I love playing with Arlo. I love playing with Abe and these other people that Arlo has around him. And that's, I didn't know it, but that was the goal that I was really trying to reach for all my life, was to get to go out on the road with great people who are really great friends and who treat me with respect and who I like being around. And so I think I'm just as lucky as can be. And then when I'm not on the road, I get to go sing for kids. So what can be better?
Tell us about your writing.
Well, I've always tried to write a little bit. I wrote a song for Arlo that I wrote the words for years ago that he put the music to. It's called Oh Mom. And it's about growing up with a mom who's grew up during the 60s and forced you to eat granola and, you know, stuff like that. It's just kind of, I go for the comedy, mm-hmm. as you know. And so that was my first semi-successful song. And then I started writing songs for kids just because I like doing it. And I'm not really prolific like Tom Paxton is. He can sit down and write song after song after song, and they're all great. I have to kind of suffer over them.
Tom Paxton is quite a human being. The Shartocks have always put up many of the acts that perform at the Guthrie Church. And so we've gotten to know Tom a little bit over the years. He's a terrific guy, really a nice man.
Yes, he is.
Now, you know, folk music is populated by nice people and bad boys. So what happens when you go on the road with a bad boy?
I don't actually know.
You never met anybody who wasn't good.
Well, I've been very, very lucky. I've gotten to play with some really wonderful people and, you know, avoided a lot of the pitfalls. But I've seen them, you know. I remember we opened for some band down in Poughkeepsie, and I won't even say the name of the band, but they were backstage and we were the opening act, and they just looked terrible. They looked on death's door, and they were doing this and that, you know, over in the corner.
Sure.
And we're looking at them and they looked at us, and they're like, yeah, it's tough out here on the road, isn't it? And we said, yeah, I guess it is. And we said, so how long have you guys been out here on the road? I said, almost a week. Thought, nah, this is not the way to go.
What is the riding on the bus like? What is the priority of being on the bus? Who gets what seats?
Oh, there's no priority. On our last few tours, the family tour, We had, I think, 17 people on our bus. Arlo has two buses, and one bus is totally for him.
Yeah.
And it's not that he doesn't like people. It's not set up as a band bus. When he bought it from somebody that had built it as a motorhome. So it only has one bed. It has a big, couches and stuff like that. So it's not set up for a band. So he has another bus that's set up for a band. It has 12 bunks so we can all, lie down and couches and whatnot. But we had 17 of us during the family tour on the bus along with, we had 5-year-olds and 10-year-olds and, a bunch of adults. And it's very funny. It's just very funny. Instead of the old days where we'd sit around drinking beer and playing cards, we had Teletubbies on the TV, and it's diapers everywhere, and it's totally different and wonderful, absolutely wonderful. We had the best time.
Did I hear that you wrote a song for Carly Simon?
I wrote a song with Carly Simon.
Interesting. Tell us about it.
That was back also in my teenage years. I was at a camp in Stockbridge, which isn't there anymore. It was a wonderful arts camp called Indian Hill.
Oh, yeah, very famous.
And actually, Arlo's mother worked there. Marjorie worked there. And I went there as a camper for a couple of years, and then I would go back in because I knew the people that ran it very well. And they would have me in to play timpani or play drums or things, even though I was not really a camper anymore. And Carly Simon was a counselor there. And so we had kind of a faculty band. And this was long before she had met James or she had
James
recorded.
James Taylor to the Uninitiated, yes.
Right. Recorded any of her own music.
Yeah.
And she was another really influential person for me. She was a wonderful person.
Well, what was the song like?
It was a terrible song. It was called Secret Saucy Thoughts for Susie.
Was this a rock and roll song? Or
yeah, sort of a pseudo-pop song. And I think she eventually got a 60s band called The Elephant's Memory to record it at some point. But it never went anywhere, and, rightly so.
And here I thought it was You're So Vain.
Oh, yeah. Right. No, it was long before that.
Yeah.
But she was a wonderful person. And years later, I saw her at Tanglewood while she was married to James at one of his concerts. And we were hanging out backstage, and she introduced me to James as her first drummer. And I thought that was very nice. And
we're talking to Terry Alaberry, born Terry Hall. On your driver's license, what does it say? Terry Hall or Terry Alaberry?
It says Terry Hall.
Oh, it does.
But I kind of feel like, Miracle on 34th Street in that the United States Postal Service delivers letters to Terry Alaberry, and they all come to me. So I figure that sort of makes it official.
Yeah, but you've never wanted to change it officially.
No need at all.
Yeah.
Nope. I couldn't care less. People can call me anything they want.
So you put out tapes and CDs. How does that all go?
Well, the last, because of the technology, which is great now, the last CD that I did almost totally at home, just by myself, one little piece at a time.
What's it called?
It's called Bad Kitty. And had a lot of fun doing it. And I wrote almost half the songs on it this time, which is more than I usually do. And I did a couple of Woody Guthrie songs because I knew the anniversary was coming up. And also because I love the songs. Mm. One's called Don't You Push Me Down, which I figure is the first anti-bullying song ever written. And he wrote it probably 70 years ago. It's a great song.
What's the message?
Very simple. Don't you push me down. You can play with me. You can use my toys. But don't you push me down. It's a simple message, and it just couldn't be plainer.
How does Woody figure into the mix?
He's just kind of always there. I think he's always there for Arlo. He's always there for the Guthrie family. And by osmosis, I think, he's crept into me too. And that's a really cool thing.
Do you ever look back at Terry Ellerberry, Terry Hall, and say, you know, I miss this or I miss that? Or have you moved on to different plateaus as you've gone?
Oh, not so much. I think I always wanted, my goal in life was to be a character actor and to be the next door neighbor who comes running in the middle of the show, has about two or three lines, everybody laughs hysterically, and then he goes off.
And now, actually, Arlo had that in a sitcom one time.
He did.
In which he played the next door neighbor and came in and was the hippie.
Exactly. He got to do it.
Oh, he got rats. To do it, yeah.
But that was my goal in life, and I still would have liked to have done that.
Well,
but,
why don't you audition? Can you get somebody to help you audition for those?
It's not too late. You know, maybe if I get crusty enough in my old age or something, I'll
residuals,
be the right character.
Residuals forever.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, right.
Oh, like that's important.
Right.
Yeah.
So what is the lesson for all of us about music? In other words, I love to play music. I'm not that good, but I love to. I have a band, the Berkshire Ramblers. We play around. It's just great fun. But I think a lot of people are off-put by it. They feel that if they're not going to be the greatest, they shouldn't do it.
Well, that's just crazy. I will never be the greatest drummer. I'll never be the greatest, singer. I'm by far not the greatest singer, but I do it anyway because I really enjoy it. And the kids seem to enjoy seeing me perform, maybe because I'm not the greatest.
And you're accessible.
I don't need to be the greatest. I need to show them that they can do anything that they want. If they want to sing, they don't have to be a great singer. If they want to play the drums, they don't have to be a great drummer. It's all about finding things that you really enjoy and that you love. And I think people can love music. My dad loved music, and he couldn't play a note. He just appreciated it. So I think it's really important to show kids when they're 3 years old and on up that music is accessible to everybody and that you don't have to be a famous person to do it. All you need to do is get up. And that's why my shows gradually, they've just sort of morphed into being more interactive. And it's more about getting the kids up doing stuff than me performing for them. And so that's what I'm trying to do this year, is I'm trying to go into schools, temples, churches, anywhere where there's a group of kids and get them up and doing something. Because I'm really kind of upset about the whole childhood obesity thing. And I know it's a button topic that a lot of people talk about and stuff, but it's really long-reaching, and it's something that I've suffered with all my life. I've always had a weight problem. I've always had issues of weight. And if I can just go into this a little bit. In my late 20s, after being on the road for years and years, I had really developed a serious weight problem. And my doctor suddenly told me that my blood pressure was off the charts. And all the other things that go along with that, you know, the little contributing factors. And he put me on serious blood pressure medicine, and he said that I would be on it for the rest of my life, that I'd always have to be medicated. And I didn't accept that, and I started walking. And I also watched my diet, but mainly it was walking. And I didn't do running.
Like Forrest Gump, who went across America, you started walking?
I did.
How far did you go?
I walked across America. You know, everywhere that we went on the road, I would go out and walk. And I found that I loved it. It wasn't something that I felt like I had to do. It was something that I had this.
Become addicted?
Yeah, absolute addiction to walking. And after about 3 years, they took me off all medication. And for the last 30 years, I haven't had to take any kind of medication for anything.
Still walking?
I walk all the time. You know, when we go on the road now, first thing I do when I get to a hotel or somewhere is I look around to see what's around. And
I'm very familiar with this pattern.
For most people, for most of the other guys in the band, I'm not naming any names, you know, if it isn't within a few blocks or something, they don't want to go. But I look and I see if there's someplace I want to go that's 2 miles away, nothing, nothing. I just walk out the door and I go. And I find, even in these big cities, that there are great walking trails now. Wherever there's a river, they've put a walking trail. And it's wonderful. And you get to see such great things. And it's so great for your mind.
Have you played New Orleans?
Yes.
And there's a good walking town.
Yep, great walking town.
And Austin.
Austin and Wichita, Kansas. I mean, who would think? And Oklahoma City. I found a nice little river with a great walking trail. So, yeah, I feel like I walk across America.
Anybody ever get up and walk with you?
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes. Abe will take a walk with me and Bobby Sweet and, you know, some of the other guys. But generally, I go by myself. And that's fine. And the things that I've seen have just been incredible. I mean, it's just it's a wonderful thing. So I wrote a song. It's called The Walking Song, oddly enough. And that's one of the songs that I go into schools and sing for kids, and I talk to them about walking because it doesn't cost anything. You don't need special equipment. Anybody can do it. And it's a great thing to do with your family, too, and or your friends or... So that's the kind of thing that those are the messages that I'm trying to sneak in because kids will come and I can entertain them. I can make them happy and I can sing songs with them. I can get them singing songs. But if I can leave them with a couple of little messages that they wouldn't normally get, I think that's worth doing.
Our guest has been musician, producer, performer, Terry Oliveri, Terry All. Terry, I don't think there's anybody I know who doesn't love you. And we thank you for coming in and being with us and spending all this time with us. It's just great to talk to you and to hear about an amazing career so far. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so, so much. It's been a pleasure.
I head out the door and just walk. You can travel by plane if you're going quite far. You can travel by boat or by train or by car. But when you get there, no matter where you are, put on your shoes and just walk. You can walk down the beach with the ocean at your reach. You can walk down the block. Take a nice easy pace and you're starting to rock. What can you see if you just stare at your TV? There's a great world out there that you'll never see from your easy chair. So put one foot in front of the other. Take the hand of your father or your mother, your best friend, your sister or your brother. Take the first step and just walk.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.
Some people like to take a taxi that rushes up and down and back and forth at such a frantic, frantic pace. But I prefer to take things slow and try a nice stroll with the wind at my face. You might be amazed how great you will feel if you rely on your feet, not your automobile. It might seem too far, but come on now, get real. Get off your butt and just walk. You can walk fast or slow, no matter where or when you go. If you walk with a friend, you'll be the winner in the end. What can you see if you stare at your TV? There's a great world out there that you'll never see from your easy chair. So put one foot in front of the other. Take the hand of your father or your mother, your best friend, your sister or your brother.
Take the first step and just you'll be the best if you take the first step and just walk.